Okay, so we're in Daniel chapter 3, starting in verse 10, says, "Your Majesty has issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, Your Majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up." Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold that I have set up? Now when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up." Yeah. Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude toward them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent that the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, "Weren't there 3 men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, your majesty." He said, "Look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the 4th looks like a son of the gods." Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their head singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other god can save in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Yeah! Woo!
Hey guys, wow, that is bright. Hey, welcome to the last outpost of the year and the last large group. We are excited to just have this time tonight to celebrate together what the Lord has done in our life, in our community, in our fellowship. And we're wrapping up this series where we've been looking at, really, Jesus in the Old Testament. And we've been looking at these times throughout the Old Testament where God shows up in some physical way. He basically shows up and reveals himself in such a way that the people that are around are transformed by that. And we see in this story, really, this happen in a pretty profound way. Even Nebuchadnezzar recognizes, hey, there is this one like the son of the gods. And actually the word there is Elohim, like Elohim in the original Hebrew. And in this we see really a powerful expression of Christ. But I want to talk about this a little bit tonight because what we are looking at right now is a lot of friends who have just made a commitment to serve the Lord in a public way, to publicly profess their faith in front of all of you tonight. Some of you guys are about to graduate. This time next week, you will be done with school, maybe forever, and your life is going to take on a different course, a different direction. And how do you live out your faith in a public way, in the real world? Some of you guys are going off into internships, going off into programs for the summer, and you're going to be, how do I live out my faith in this way, in this public arena, in this public setting? So I just want to look at this story, because in this story we see a couple of different ways that this story shows us what does it look like to live out a public faith. And particularly we see this story show us how did Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, how did their faith affect their public, their life in a social way, in a private way, in the personal way, and in a communal way? How did their faith affect how they lived their life socially? How did it affect how they lived out their life personally? How did it cause them to change how they lived out their faith in community? And so we're just going to look at a couple of those tonight. First one, how does this story show us how they lived out their faith socially? It's interesting in verse 17, it says, "If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will, from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." Now, before that, here they are. I mean, these guys, why does Nebuchadnezzar care? Why does he care about these guys? Why does it matter what they do or don't do? Why is Nebuchadnezzar so furious with them? Well, we actually see in verse 12, it says, "But there are some Jews," this is the accusation, "whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." And what we see in this story is that actually Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are very influential in the Babylonian society. Now, Babylon at that time was the greatest society maybe that had ever been, as far as power, that had ever been on the earth up until that point. And Babylon was incredibly powerful for a number of reasons. One of the things is that they had this incredible way of actually ruling the peoples that they conquered. Many people had been conquered and conquering before this, but Babylon figured out, if we take the ruling class, if we take the young people from the ruling class, and we bring them to Babylon, and we really indoctrinate them into what it looks like to be a Babylonian, in the values of our culture, in the society around us, and our gods, and our worship, and our culture, then we basically will begin to be able to rule the world, because we won't have everybody competing with our value system, because they will have owned our way of living, and our way of thinking, and our way of doing things. And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, actually, they're Jewish names, that's their Babylonian names, but they were Jewish young men that, when Israel had been conquered by the Babylonians, were taken to Babylon to be trained. And we see that these guys have these incredible places of influence. Now, the thing that's fascinating to me is that in this account, what we see in their life, if you read through the story of Daniel, what we see in their life is that these young men are holding in tension so well something that sometimes is very hard for the rest of us to emulate. And that is that they are living in the world, but they are not letting the world affect their faith. That they are holding that tension together. Because we have this tendency in faith to kind of go on extremes unintentionally sometimes intentionally. I've been in countries where this is almost an intentional act, but on one hand, we're like, this is my community. These are my brothers. These are my sisters. This is you know, my campus ministry. This is my small group. This is my group. This is my thing. And we so infuse our life into the Christian world that we have no interaction of any significance with the rest of the world. And so we're kind of over here hanging out, and we're saying, hey, come to us. But there's no interaction. There's no impact in the rest of the world. You know that the reason why Nebuchadnezzar had this incredible interaction with the God of Yahweh, well, he had this revelation, and he kind of goes this other extreme. He kind of realized the time and place. He's like, you know, I'm going to kill you because you didn't, you know, bow to my gods. Oh, yeah, your God's right. Okay, I'm going to kill anybody else that doesn't obey your God. You know, it's kind of like, he's just like, but he has this crazy revelation of God because Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are in his world. They're infusing the values in the kingdom of God. He, Nebuchadnezzar, brought Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from Israel to Babylon to infuse his values into their life. And what ends up happening is the kingdom of God begins to infuse the God's values into his life, into his world. But so often we're kind of over here and we don't have any interaction with the world, and so we kind of have this thing over here. Other times we do the opposite. We're over here and we're just saying, hey, I need to, you know, love this world, and I have these friends, and then, you know, I'm just going to be a witness. I'm going to be that kind of thing. And I suddenly lose my tether, my camaraderie, my community of faith, and I start to lose that connection. And before long, I become disillusioned and watered down in my faith and all these kind of things. But we see in these young men, they held these tensions together. Jesus would say it this way. He said, you must be light and salt, right? And light is interesting because light, if you think of light, if you think of like candles, every time you have a candle, the more of you that have a candle, the brighter the room gets. And one, you know, I don't know, Derek, pull out your phone. Turn it on. Turn on a light. All right? Now that whole row, turn on the light. Light it up. All right, this whole section, do it. See, the more lights we put together, the more it begins to illuminate. And there's something about we need to be together. We need to be corporate. We need to have our identity. You guys can put those away. That's great. Thank you. But so I'm gonna be like, all right, that's enough. But that's too much light for right now. Just keep, you know, hide under a bushel. So what we're doing. What did you learn from your campus pastor this week? I think it was heresy, but I don't know. He meant well. So over here, you need the more of you that are together, worshiping, loving God, loving each other, honoring each other, serving each other. The community is what is powerful. But on the other side is this sense of you need to also be salt. And we don't realize, but this is actually a tension Jesus is creating. He is actually contrasting the two. Because in that time, I think I was talking with Ashley. We were talking about this a couple weeks ago. But salt at that time in the world was useful for a couple of things. It was useful, one, as a preservative, because at that time where, you know, you don't have a refrigerator or a freezer or some kind of strange, like, preservative system that we do in our day and age, you know, it's almost like unnatural, like how long we can preserve food sometimes. But we don't have that at that time. So salt is a preservative. It's also an enhancer of flavor. We're also, there's not a lot of spices in this part of the world. There's not, you know, food is pretty bland most of the time. I mean, even to this day, what do? If I have a good steak, all I want on it is salt. Why? Because salt enhances the flavor of the food. And so here Jesus is saying, you need to be the salt of the earth. You need to be the thing that is preserving the world, that is holding it together, that is keeping things in a sense of godliness and righteousness and the beauty and the creation of God, infusing that into the world. You need to be the flavor enhancer of society, that it's the Christian world that should be advancing the things of art and business. And you know, I'm a business guy by training. It's amazing to me when I read like business books, because I do that once in a while, like how many principles I find actually are paralleling really the Christian worldview or a moral ideal, because what they've begun to realize is morality is in line with reality. And the things that actually work in this world are in line with reality, and that's why they are working so well. But it's so fascinating, like leadership books also. But we are called to be this preservative, keeping the world from going down the paths that are not of God. And even though there's all kinds of competitive different views and values and different things, that we are in there infusing our values there. See, Babylon began to come to know the goodness of God because these men were holding these tensions together, not watering down their faith in community, but also working to advance that. Jeremiah, actually, God told Jeremiah, you need to go into Babylon, and you need to bless the city and serve the city and minister to the city and pray for the city, that it's in this working it out. And so here are these men, and they're very successful. But in their success, it's about serving the Lord. So in this idea, in society, that it affected the way they approached socially their worldview, not being separatists in their worldview. Because we so often have this tendency of either being a separatist in our mindset. But so often not, if it's not in our actions, it is in our mindsets. If it's not in our actions, we have a tendency of separating within ourselves what is spiritual. And we start to do this, we start to become a separatist in our time. So this is my small group meeting, and this is my Devo time, and this is my time where I am like intentionally reaching out and sharing my faith. And so this is my God time. And then over here I have my fluids exam that I'm freaking out about because finals is coming next week, and I've got my Calc 2. I mean, have you ever done Calc 2? I've got all this, and this, I've got my career, and I've got my job, and I've got my work, and this is somehow different. I am delineating my life, my faith, from those. That there's two separate things in my world. That it's interesting, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, here they are, and they are being incredibly productive in society, and yet they're also ardent in their faith. And they've actually done a lot of research finding, like, why are some people just very kind of gritty? I was talking to the LTC students about this a little while ago. Why are some people just more resilient? And one of the things that they have found that is key is that if you have an ultimate concern in your life, that everything else is serving, then you have this resilience. But if you don't, if you have competing concerns, if you have competing objectives, because every goal has a different goal that has a different goal, right? What's the why behind the why? Start acting like a two-year-old. Why? But why? But why? You know, you start, we sometimes say, why do you do the things you do? Who do you do them for? Right? Why do I do what I'm doing? Who do I do it for? And if you have an ultimate concern that everything else is serving, then you have this resilience. You have this grittiness. But if you don't, if you have multiple ultimate concerns, then eventually those things will start to compete with one another. And if my career is delineated from my life over here, my faith and my work, my family and my, you know, ministry, if my different parts of my life start to delineate, not in the functionality or the priority of like who needs time and where I was at, but in the sense of why I am doing what I'm doing, eventually that ultimate concern will start to compete. And then I have to decide who is really Lord, right? Everybody has a Lord. It's the thing that ultimately makes the decisions and wins the day when you have competing concerns. So what is that thing in your life? Now, we have these friends that just got baptized, and what they are saying is that everything is ultimately about the Lord, that every consideration, every decision. But it's so easy for us to start to delineate in our life these two areas. Like, yes, I do this stuff, but I don't really see how fluids or making a cup of coffee as a barista or how, you know, being a teacher really has anything to do with faith unless I can share my faith. But do you realize in the garden, let's jump back to the beginning of this whole story. In the garden, God sets up the world, and he puts a little nucleus of his goodness, of his beauty, of his character, of his kingdom, in all of its power and glory, how he designed in his image, so to speak, how he wants the world to be. And it's interesting to me that he didn't create the whole world that way. He let the world be what it was going to be, and then he put this little nucleus in the middle of it, and he said, all right, now advance that. And he told humanity, you have a role to play. Now tell me this, who was Adam ministering to? Who was he witnessing to? You know, it was like the sheep in the field, like, hey, have you ever heard of like, you know, Isaiah? No, you haven't, because he hasn't been born yet. So, right, like there's, what is ministry to him? It's working with the Lord. It's doing things for the Lord, even though there is nothing directly, intuitively spiritual about what he is quote-unquote doing. Everything becomes spiritual. And that's not to minimize the priority of what I'm talking about. You guys get that. We're in the outpost. You've been around long enough. You realize, like, the ultimate concern of the Lord's heart is, hey, the only eternal beings in this world are the people sitting around you in class or at work. Or, you know, so God's ultimate heart is like, hey, I have to take a step back. And I have to work more fundamentally because you were supposed to be the ones advancing my garden. And now you're the ones competing against my garden in this world. And so I'm going to have to work on you to get you back to that place. But in the sense of what is spiritual, everything becomes spiritual. They were gardeners. It's interesting that even in the Great Commission, even in the work of ministry, of sharing my faith and growing people in discipleship and walking with people and, you know, all those stuff, in that we still find God doesn't need us. I mean, he does in the sense of, hey, he set up the world in such a way that he was going to make it to where we had freedom and a right over this world. So in that sense, he kind of set it up that way, but that's not like in his absolute need. There wasn't in that original design. He didn't have to do it that way. He didn't have to make that work this way so that he partnered with us. I mean, he could have sent angels down to do Bible study for you instead of, like, you know, you opening up the Bible and trying to figure out how to teach your friends, right? That would be pretty cool. Like, okay, it's, you know, Tuesday night, we're going to have the angel come and share with us, right? That means he doesn't need you, and yet he wants to do it with you. Why? Because it's in the partnership. It's in the motivation of saying, I am doing this for the Lord and with the Lord, that the power comes, the intimacy is grown. That side by side, I think we talked about that earlier this semester, side by side, relationship often is forged. And so God is calling us into that place. But, you know, I talk about my sons. My sons, they'll make, like, art. And there's nothing about that art that is, like, you know, I was just in Washington, D.C. here a few weeks ago, and I went to the National Art Gallery, or the one that's in D.C., and, you know, they have, like, Picassos and stuff like that. I mean, I love my kids, but nobody's putting that up on the wall saying this is the standard by which, you know, all art should be measured, right? It's just little squiggly lines, and I'm like, is that a, you know, hippopotamus? And they're like, no, it's you, Daddy. I'm like, oh, okay, great. No, but, and yet, I couldn't have cared less about the Picasso, but I care about that piece of art that my kid did because he did it for me. And the point is simply this, that when you go into finals next week and when you get that internship this summer and when you get that career after you graduate, the question is not, hey, how do I distinguish, how do I do ministry and not and all the other things in my life, but realizing that how do you make everything ministry? How do you make everything an act of ministry to the heart of God, saying, I am expressing love to you in this, even though it doesn't have a direct connection, quote-unquote, into an eternal thing or in any other way other than to say, I am doing this for you. And all of a sudden, loving the heart of God becomes making a cup of coffee and saying, here you go, right? That's for you, Jen. So here we are, and socially, these guys start to realize everything is spiritual. Everything is physical. That I think is fascinating when a spiritual reality is created in the kingdom of God, God sets up a spiritual or a physical expression. That the spiritual reality of salvation needed a physical expression, so he created baptism. But then, whenever there's a physical reality, we find that they're like doing maybe fluids, it actually has a spiritual component. That everything is physical. Everything becomes spiritual. The second area we see here is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, how their faith affects them personally. And there's, with them, verse 17 and 18, right, they basically say, we're not bowing, God will save us. Even if he doesn't, we're not changing. That's fascinating to me. I just can't get over this, the way that they have set up their life in such a way to be so resilient. And so we talked, you know, we just talked about that, the that their hierarchy of priority were so clear-cut. It wasn't like they delineated, right? The story is like, hey, Nebuchadnezzar is furious. They're not able to be like, hey, we'll converse for a minute and get back to you. Like, no, I mean, in that moment, there is no debating, there's no questioning, there's no second guessing. They are just firm. That their faith is so secure, so firm, that what they are doing is so in line with the kingdom of God. Because they are secure in why they are doing it. Why they do what they do. Who are they doing it for? And they're so secure in that they don't second guess it at all. They just move forward. No matter what happens. Do you realize the level of confidence and assurance that gives you? You know how optimistic you can be because of that? Right? Here they are because it doesn't actually matter. Right? Well, you're not optimistic about next week because your life identity is starting to get wrapped up in whether or not you're going to get that career or you're going to get that job or you're going to get that thing. And you're not sure if you're going to get it. Some of you are going to fail a test next week. Some of you are going to not get the internship that you thought you were going to get. Some of you aren't going to have the career you originally intended. And if that is where you're finding your sense of identity personally, then everything starts to shake because you're not certain if you will attain that. But you have to go deeper. You have to go more foundational. And here is God, and here is the Lord of the universe, and they are saying, I am serving God. That is my agenda. That is my purpose. You could kill me or not. That doesn't change my agenda. And because that was their agenda, that was their purpose, they could find in persecution and in success, they could find this North Star, this consistency that saw them through both. I think it's fascinating that in persecution, sometimes it's easy to forge our convictions. It's like in that place of like battle, we're like, yes, I will not bow. But it's in that place of success that sometimes things get watered down. And they experienced both, and neither held them from the course, the agenda of their life. Give me the kingdom, give me the keys to the kingdom, or give me death. Either way doesn't matter because it's not about what I get out of either of these. It's about what I am doing in either of these, that I am glorifying God. And because they had such a resilience, do you see how resilient that makes you? When you come up to a situation and you might lose everything because you have to do the right thing, you don't question that because it's not what you get out of it. It's about who you are serving, because who you get out of it is the Lord. And he is with you in the fire. And he is with you in the success. That he is with you no matter what. And that's the point that we see in how their life was so transformative personally. You know, we see, interestingly enough, it's really fascinating how, because, I mean, they were just optimistic. Because they could be. Because it mattered. Of course it mattered. They didn't want to get thrown in the fire. But in the sense of how they made decisions, it didn't matter. And so they could choose to be optimistic. Now you get to your test and you're like, I don't know, because you're not, your security isn't founded in something that is secure in the midst of the storm. Jesus slept in the boat, right? Even though the storm was going around him. And there's this sense of security. Can you find security in the storm, or does it have to be when the storm is calm that you can find your security? So many people, they find their security when the storm is calmed, instead of realizing that what we are called to as followers of Christ is to find our security in something deeper than the storm, something more foundational in the storm, that even when the storms of life come, that it doesn't move us, doesn't shake us, doesn't change our trajectory or our outlook. And that gives us such freedom to think, God is all about you, so I'm going to be optimistic in my outlook of how you're going to approach this. But I don't care. If you don't come in the way I think you're going to come in, that's okay. I'm still not going to change course, because it's about serving you. See how powerful that faith is? How resilient that faith is? The last thing I'll say is, how did this affect their faith in community? How did their faith affect their outlook of community? And I commented a minute ago, but they never said, well, Shadrach thinks we should do this, and Meshach is kind of on the fence, and Abednego, you know, he's way over there. So, you know, there's this, like, they speak with one voice. There's no delineating, no deliberating, there's no arguing or questioning or second guessing. They're just, boom. And even when they're facing death, all three of them, none of them waver. Even when the guards are dying because the fire is so hot that they can't even get close enough to the fire to throw them into the furnace, they're still together. And they're forged. And I think it's so interesting, in the New Testament, sometimes we don't catch this, but there almost never in the New Testament, in the letters, almost never does it say you singular. It's almost always you plural. That we kind of internalize it personally in my personal devo life, just kind of my individualistic outlook on this. And I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, yes, to me, I live out this way, but the New Testament is all about you together, that you live out your faith, that together as a community, you bear each other's burdens, that you together are fighting for the cause of Christ in this world, that you together are going to do this. Because if you individually do it, you're not going to make it. But if you together do it, then maybe you'll do something incredible in your faith, and you'll have this resilience. I heard this analogy last week, and I thought it was such a cool one. I grew up in the Northwest, and so we have the big redwoods there up in the Northwest in North California. And you can go there, and they're just fascinating. They're huge trees. You can cut big holes in them and drive, cars through them. They're so big. But it's interesting, their root system actually isn't very deep. The reason why these giants in the forest system are able to grow so big is because they intertwine their roots with each other. That you never see a redwood by itself. You always see redwoods. It has to be a forest to hold it together. Otherwise, they would topple over. And I think that's such a fascinating analogy to our faith, that together we are stronger, because together we are intertwining our faith and relying on each other. And none of us by ourselves are so powerful that we would endure the storms of life, but together we can do it. And so we see in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego these three men holding firm to each other as they hold firm to their God. Athletes, I read a book here recently that was talking about one of the Olympic swimmers in recent past, and he was just making the comment, he said, I would have never made it here except that I was training with the best. He's one of the best. He wasn't Phelps, but he was one of the others, and he just made the comment that, he was an Olympian, but only because he had other people that every morning at 6 a.m., the community was getting up to go swim, and he was not a morning person. He's like, by himself, he would never have made it up. But every day, he was getting up, and he was swimming. And how are we pushing each other? How are we encouraging each other? What are we doing as a community? Are we pursuing the love of Christ in our world? Are we pursuing after the community of God in our lives? Are we leaning on each other and relying on each other and committing to each other and fighting for each other? Because the kingdom of God will advance as we do it together. And these men have this resilience because of this. There's two things that you guys are going to walk away with in college. Two things that have the potential to last when you leave college. One of them is your education. And one of them is your brotherhood, your sisterhood. Those are the two probably more long-lasting things you walk away with. Typically, we have a tendency of thinking, well, I'm going to walk away with my education, and I'll find brotherhood wherever I go. And that's not untrue. That's not wrong. I remember when I was at the University of Idaho, and the Lord said, Nate, go to Colorado, and I was just like, okay. Why? And he's like, don't worry about it, just go, right? Okay. And so it's kind of that step of faith. All right, God, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm leaving my athlete team, and I was leaving my university, and I'm leaving all my friends, and I'm like. So there are times when God will call us out on our own, but more often, what we say in missions is it's more important who you go with than where you go. More often, it's more important who you go with, because it's in the power of the community that anything is going to happen. And we have a tendency of thinking of ourselves, we like to think of ourselves as all being ministers. The church in America has is kind of in this thing as of late that we like to highlight that we're all missionaries. And I think it's good. I like kind of the idea of why they say what they're saying in that. And yet, if we're all going to be missionaries, some of us as accountants and teachers, some of us as cross-cultural ministers to unreached people groups, if we're all going to see ourselves that way, then shouldn't we all hold ourselves to that same standard? Because in foreign missions, what we have learned is it's more important to go with people that you love and you know. That's where the power of that's going to be. And certainly the Lord may call you out of that. I get that. But is our default to say, there are two things that I'm walking away with in college, my education and my community, my brotherhood, my sisterhood. And we have a tendency of thinking, well, I can find brotherhood or sisterhood anywhere, so I'm going to take my education, let that take me where I need to go, and then I'll figure it out. But I would challenge this. Is that really true? Do you realize how challenging? You can. I will absolutely say that. You can. But you know how much longer and more difficult and challenging it is to get to that same place that you have in the sense of vulnerability, intimacy, and camaraderie within your small group or within your community? When you're working a 9-to-5 and you're maybe 20 to 30 minutes away from your closest friend at home and you've got a wife and kids and a mortgage and you're trying to figure out how, you know how much time it takes to do what you do in a semester with each other, the level of life togetherness, the level of memory creation, the level of dependence and vulnerability. You know how challenging that is? It's tough. It's why so often many people in the church just never really get there with so many people. They have acquaintances, they have Sunday morning friends, but they don't have that sense of camaraderie. There's a study done, longest study in history that was done since after World War II, and they took these men after college and basically just spent their entire lives, and many of them are passing away now, and it's getting to the end of the study, longest study in history, psychology study, and they've done everything on these men. They've done CT scans, CAT scans. They've done psych evals all the time. They've followed them, their success, their failures, their everything. And the head of the program recently, the recent head of the program, was asked recently, okay, you guys have been doing probing these guys for years, and you've been doing all this research and all this study. What have you learned? And what they said at the end of the day was this: relationships matter. That happiness in this life has to do with the depth of the relationships. That your level of success is going to be strongly related to your level of depth of relationships. That your lifespan, that your health, that your success, that every metric that they could think of generally boiled down at some level or another back to the depth of your relationships. And at the end of the day, that maybe the most fundamental question about how your life is going to be lived is the people that are living it alongside of you. And so as you go about your life, think through, how can I do this with you? And certainly there's a lot of people in the world that are looking for brothers and sisters to live out life with. But don't walk away too quickly in your thinking, in your choices, in your lifestyle to say, I'm just going to walk away from the community and I'll create another one. Maybe take along a brother or two or a sister or two in your life and say, hey, let's do this together. Because what we see in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is three men who have been estranged from everything they've known. They've been taken away from their community. They've been taken away from their culture. They've been taken away from everything. But they have each other. And because of that togetherness, even in maybe the most pagan, backwards society of their time, in contrast to the Judeo understanding of life, they lived out their faith well. In success and in struggle, in all of the highs and lows. Read Daniel, it's a fascinating book. In all the highs and lows, these three men and this one other spend their lives living their faith well. And so I want to just close with this, that, my computer turned off on me. But as you guys begin to live out your faith, many of you have made decisions tonight to commit your life to live for the Lord, as many of you have begun to realize how do I live out my public faith for the Lord? Take the example from Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Realize that you need to recognize the whole tension between light and salt, that you need the community. And in that need for camaraderie and fellowship, that you need to hold deeply and prioritize strongly that sense of brotherhood or sisterhood that you have or that you create wherever you are and wherever you go in your life. That is where the power is going to be. And that personally, you need to make sure that the hierarchy of priority in your life is on the Lord. That what you focus on, sometimes we say it this way, that what you think about becomes your actions. And what your actions do become habits. And what your habits do become your character. And what your character is dictates your destiny. And so what do you think about? That's a great place to start. What you think about is where your Lord will be. That is your ultimate concern. Where do you focus your mind? Where do you focus your heart? Where do you focus your affection? And here is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego with their end. At this moment, they think is maybe going to be the end of their life. And we see, why could they be so resilient? Why could they live out this public faith so well? Because in the fire, you know, the fire in the Bible is often a metaphor, a literal often, but a metaphor all the same of judgment. And in this situation, we see Nebuchadnezzar in judgment over Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And yet, here they are. And in the fire, they are saved. Because another took their place. And years later, there would be another expression of God to the world. And that expression of God, that person, that God would show up in human form, and he would again walk into the fire of judgment on our behalf. And he would take our place so that the fire would not burn us, but he took it on himself. And as we walk out our faith, we can be resilient and we can be loving and expressive and honoring, but public in our devotion to the Lord, because we recognize we are serving one who has taken our place, that he has paid the price, and that we can have this relationship with the Creator God himself, the author of reality itself, is our friend because he made a way. Where there was no way for us to escape the fire, he did the impossible. So what would become our reality, what would become possible, would be salvation. And so as we celebrate salvation tonight in baptism, as we celebrate what it means to live faith out in the publicly in our life, in our community, in reality, let's remember that as we walk into the summer. So I'm going to ask the worship team if you guys can come up, and we're going to do something real quick. If you are a senior, I want you to go ahead and just stand where you are. And I know a couple of them are on the worship team, but if you are a senior about to graduate this week, I'm not trying to make it awkward for you, but if some friends around you, if you could just stand with them and just maybe lay hands on them, you know, this is just something we kind of do. If you're not used to that, it's the idea that, hey, we are just affirming together in prayer. We are praying over that person, just physical touch, making the spiritual physical. But I just want to give you guys just a couple minutes, and I want one or two of you guys just to pray over that person that you're praying with, and just affirm them, just pray over them as they're leaving, as they're graduating, that the Lord would go with them, go before them, and he would be their guide. So I want you guys to do that, and we'll jump into worship here in just a minute.